This is the Florida Spectacular Podcast with your hosts, Kathy Silustri and Rick Kilby. Keep up with Kathy at greatfloridaroadtrip.com and on Twitter and Instagram at Kathy Silustri. Find Rick on Twitter at OldFLA and visit his website, rickkilby.com. Now, discover a Florida you never knew existed.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Florida Spectacular. Rick and Kathy here with a lovely, watery guest. Today's guest is Dr. Chris Mindel, who is currently at the helm of the Florida Studies program at USF St. Petersburg, which is, if you're a longtime listener, you know something very, very near and dear to my heart. But that's not why he's here, although we do have questions for him about that. He has a new book, Florida Springs, From Geography to Politics and Restoration. And it's a lovely hardcover, heavy book with beautiful photos. But, you know, Chris is Dr. Mindel, or Chris, depending on how you know him. He is well known for his thoughts about water in Florida, at least from an education standpoint. So, no further ado, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks so much for the invitation. Been looking forward to this for a while.
Oh, well, we've been looking forward to having you because I don't know if you know, Rick's kind of into springs.
Kind of, yeah. And thanks for all the shout outs in your book. I love it. And it's, I think it's a must have for people who love Florida Springs.
Well, I tell you what, and I think highly of yours as well, your Healing Waters book. Turned me on to Green Springs, among others, and still assign it in my classes.
Thank you. We were talking about how pitiful our royalties were earlier before you got on.
Royalties? What royalties?
You'll get a very small check with the cost of postage charged back to you sometime in April, Chris. It'll be fine. Craig Pittman, who does a lot of environmental writing still, even after leaving the Times. He told me a long time ago that one of the best pieces of advice he got from University Press of Florida was somebody there said, look, the money isn't in royalties. The money is in speaking about your book. And that is absolutely true.
That is true.
And thankfully you have some experience speaking because you are a professor and they make you teach classes.
Every now and again, right?
Yeah. So I remember one of the classes I had with you. It was called People and Places, which sounds very, the title sounded very floofy, like very fluffy, easy stuff. And it was anything but. It was field trips. It was all this stuff. I remember we went on a field trip and you made us get out. We were on US 19 at the Fenn Holloway River and you made us get out and smell it. Mm-hmm. So it's clearly your bailiwick to talk about Florida water.
I just have to know, what does it smell like? Because I've never been there. I mean, there was a spring there, and it's mentioned in my books, and I know it's really bad. But so what did it smell like, though?
Well, it depends on who you ask. If you ask locals, they would say it's the smell of money. If you ask most other folks who are from outside the area, it stinks kind of like, I don't know, maybe sort of an open sewer.
Ooh.
I would say funk. It smells like funk.
Yeah,
it does. What I love about that is when I was working on Backroads, and I wrote about the Fenn Holloway, and I went to the website of the timber company, the paper product company that currently was in charge of fixing it, helping restore some of the less funky parts of the river. You went on their website, and it was this brilliant PR move where they actually blamed the trees for contaminating the river. And in reality, what it was the discharge, the effluent of the timber practices, but they made it sound like the trees had contaminated the river. And I just thought, well, that is some real toxic sludge is good for you PR spinning. That's great.
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure about this, but it may be that plant has called the state's bluff and has said, okay, if you want us to spend more money on cleaning up our mess, we're out of here. Have fun with that.
I thought the state had officially designated it as like an industrial river, you know, like it's a lost cause and don't even try and restore it.
It did in the 1940s, but then the Clean Water Act in the 1970s basically said, well, you can't do that anymore.
Oh.
All the country's waters should be swimmable and fishable. And so that's what reignited the pressure. And it was ongoing for a long time for a succession of owners to spend more to clean up the effluent they discharged as a result of their processes. I mean, it's an old plant. It was built in the 1940s. Very new plants can like continually recycle their water and have little or no harmful discharges. But this was an older plant, and they were just trying to keep it going as long as possible because it was profitable. And but then environmental rules and environmental regulators made it less profitable over time. And as the biggest source of jobs in Taylor County, there was pressure on regulators to let it go.
Oh, so does the spring still flow there? Because I don't even know.
I don't think so.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I don't know for certain. I've not examined that property. And I will say I don't think so, if only because they were voracious users of groundwater, and that would have dried up any spring flow. If it's true and they're not pumping as much or hardly any groundwater from there now, that spring, I don't know. It may flow again. We shall see.
It's so funny because, you know, I have this by my desk, bulletin number 31 from the, you know, that is the book of Springs of Florida from the Geological Survey. And it doesn't even have Van Holloway Springs under Taylor County. It's not even listed.
Right.
And this is from the 1970s.
Yes. If you go to the Florida Geological Survey's current database lists over 1,100 springs, you'll find that there are many that they have not yet properly documented. There are people. In fact, I was at a talk in Gainesville a couple of weeks ago, and somebody from Taylor County out towards the coast said, oh, do you know if have you ever been to this spring? And I'm like, no. He says, do you know if the state has documented it? And I says, I'm pretty sure they haven't. And that's not uncommon. We say the state has over 1,100 springs, but it's likely to be a fair bit more. Now, we know where all the whoppers are.
There's no Weeki Wachee or manatee out there that we haven't found yet.
No, those things have been discovered. It's these smaller ones. And they aren't necessarily super small, but they're in out-of-the-way places or perhaps on private property that's difficult to get to without an invitation or in remote parts of public properties and are small enough and perhaps in densely forested areas so that the remote sensing images, the aerial photography can't pick them out.
I think a lot of them are covered with groundwater when it's really wet, and you can only find them in times of drought when, you know, they're able to flow to the surface.
Right. And that's true of a lot of the springs on the Suwannee River, for example. I think many of those were not discovered until significant drought lowered water levels.
Yeah.
And then water comes pouring out from the sides or the bank.
Well, I'm looking now on the DEP websites for the Geological Survey's springs page, and they don't show. There's one in Gulfport, less than a mile from my house, that is not on here. And I think because it's on private property and it's close to the bay, that they don't count it. But the good news is you can report a spring. Like, we're still discovering springs so much that you can go to this page and there is a link. Do you not see a spring here? Report the spring, and you can help discover springs in Florida, which I didn't know was a thing.
So. Since we have you on, because I see things and I wonder, is that a spring, you know, like that's on the econ, you can see water kind of oozing out of the banks and they're like seepage. Is that considered a spring or a water table spring?
Generally speaking, A spring is a point, or maybe a collection of points closely spaced together. Sometimes we'll say springs in the plural, where water's bubbling up out of the ground. But there are other incidences, maybe more like what you've described, where water seems to be oozing out over a somewhat broader area, not a small, easily defined orifice. And those are generally not regarded as springs. I guess we go back to what the definition of these things really is. What's the meaning of words? And so I think that's essentially what most people refer to as a spring. Is it spring-like? Of course. Should we call it a spring? I don't know. Not unless we can maybe find an orifice or two or three, where water bubbles up out of the ground.
Does it matter what aquifer is feeding it? I mean, does it have to be from the Floridan aquifer, or could it be from a, could it still be a spring from a surficial aquifer that's above the Floridan
Yes,
aquifer?
yes. And in fact, there are seepage springs, usually in North Florida, where there's a little bit more topography, where there is water from the surficial aquifer making its way downslope beneath the surface that bubbles up out of the ground. The Miami area used to have a series of springs, but that was before significant settlement and significant groundwater use. Those springs were almost certainly fed by the Biscayne Aquifer, which is pretty prolific, even today, but it is now very heavily used. And as a result, that reduced the pressure, on the groundwater to the point where those springs, I'll say, probably don't flow anymore. I don't think anybody's been able to find any. I think I looked online once, and there's some people doing some scuba diving trying to find them. Fascinating old photo, by the way, of what was his name? Monroe was his last name.
Kirk Monroe.
Yes, he was a boat builder and an early 20th century Miami person. And there's a fabulous photograph from the state archives that shows him out there in Biscayne Bay, and there is clearly water bubbling up from the bottom of the bay.
Yeah, I've heard apocryphal stories of how the conquistadors, with their galleons, would know that there was this wa water bubbling up in the middle of Biscayne Bay, and would stop, and there are they in the Bulletin 31, they call them submarine springs, and you have a really cool map of one of yours that's flowing off of Pinellas County.
Yes. Beautiful photo, and it's compliments of Google for crying out loud. There you go with the eyes in the sky. But this thing is just what, a handful of 100 feet off the coast, right next to the big expensive houses on the waterfront, and of course this one's been explored. There's been some scuba divers go down there, and they've followed the cave system underneath those houses and inland a little ways. Of course, none of this activity should be taken on or should be taken lightly
Yeah,
or be
do
engaged in.
not cave dive, please.
No, this activity really does call for significant training, and sadly, tragically, people who are not as experienced, it's easy to get confused, it's easy to get mixed up, and you really don't have any margin for error. So, my goodness, please get training if you're interested in this kind of activity, because that's what it calls for.
Well, cave diving, not even aquifer diving, but cave diving in Florida is the only place where you'll see a government sign with a Grim Reaper on the sign. I think that should tell you right there, maybe not for everybody. And have you seen the videos, the West Skiles videos of going through the Floridan aquifer?
Sadly, not his videos, but certainly his still photographs are spectacular.
Yeah,
And
they're but both, I mean either one, but they're just very awe-inspiring.
Yeah, there's a PBS documentary, I think it's called A Water's Journey,
Yes.
that traces them. And you know, I remember years ago before I was really into springs, being fascinated because they have somebody on the surface following them with some radio thing when it goes back and forth, and they're walking through the middle of a Sonny's restaurant right by the salad bar. And so hundreds of feet below them is the scuba diver. They're following them on land. They go through a parking lot in Albertsons. So they're somewhere near the Wekiva. Because I know that where the Albertsons used to be. It's really interesting.
It is spectacular, and now that you mention it, I have seen that and used that video in classes a lot. And one of the fascinating things about that is they aren't just taking advantage of springs. They may enter in a spring and then they pop up in a sinkhole somewhere where there's maybe some, you know, modest water at the surface, looks like a small pond. And then you start to see the bubbles from the scuba divers, and then sure enough, they pop up. It is absolutely first rate and eye-opening in terms of what's going on beneath our feet.
They're small, they charge with USBs, they're lightweight, they're awesome. You put it on, you go outside, within 4 seconds, the concept of having to touch seems absolutely insane.
I'm 100% with you. I no longer want to have any headlamps that doesn't respond to a voice command.
Having this in camping would be amazing because you're just like walking around, getting your stuff all dialed with it on, and you cozy into your sleeping bag with a book. As soon as you get used to the fact that you can talk to it, I just can't believe that all headlamps aren't like it. It's such an obvious benefit.
Yeah, I can't believe it's taken this long. You'll find the link to our episode in this podcast episode's description area. Please give us a try.
I have another technical question. What is a swallet? I've heard about SWALLET, springs, sinks, and swallets. What is a swallet?
Yeah. Well, springs and sinkholes have a lot in common. They are holes in the ground.
Right.
Sinkholes, generally speaking, water flows down, but you know, only when the sinkhole collapses, and maybe after it rains, some runoff gets into that sinkhole. Springs are typically where water bubbles up from the ground to the surface. Swallets, though, are places generally beneath rivers that will gobble up significant quantities of surface flow on a much more regular basis, much more regular basis than a sinkhole would.
So and, like the place where the Santa Fe River goes underground, that's a swallet?
Yes, yes,
okay.
yes.
Okay.
So as you know, if you look at a map of the Santa Fe River, goes along, and then all of a sudden it appears to dissipate, hits a dead end. And there are, by the way, several swallet holes beneath the Santa Fe River. Many before that dead end are gobbling up only a small portion of the river's flow. But at the dead end, that's where all of the river's flow ends up being gobbled up and making its way into the ground. And then moving a handful of miles downslope beneath the surface, mingling with some additional groundwater, and then bubbling up as the Santa Fe River Rise, just a few miles away at Santa Fe River Rise State Park.
So is that a spring then where it comes up, or is it not? Because is it going to the aquifer, or is it just kind of going, you know, under the surface?
Well, it's really a little bit of both.
Okay.
Definitely, you know, river water is making its way through probably multiple channels before bubbling up to the surface. But it is also mingling with significant quantities of groundwater. And in different places, for example, in the St. Mark's up in just near Tallahassee, up in the Panhandle, I think the Water Management District up there has said, yeah, the St. Mark's River dives down. Basically, it does so multiple places, multiple times. But they found, I think they've estimated a significant quantity of groundwater, not just river water, bubbles up. So in different places, these river rises will have different percentages of river water versus groundwater. They always have some groundwater in addition to river water. They're not merely the river flowing underground and then popping up at the surface. there's almost always some groundwater. And sometimes that groundwater contribution is significant. So then the issue is, well, should we call that a spring? It depends on who you ask, you know, who wants to do the defining.
Yeah.
The legislature has done the defining in terms of outstanding Florida springs, and they have said, no, we're not going to recognize River Rises as outstanding Florida springs.
I mean, I would
think... Isn't that really just a matter of semantics?
Yeah.
I mean, I get that there are geological differences, but isn't the end result the same? It's some of the purest water on the planet
that's the
coming
question,
up at
though,
the surface.
If it's tannin stained water, though, like from the Santa Fe, you know, that has all the, you know, the leaves and all that kind of stuff, it's maybe not clear when it's rising again.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That water coming up from the Santa Fe River Rise is not beautiful, blue, green, whatever. It's got a lot of that tannin staining in it from all of the organic material that's in various stages of breaking down. So, yes, it's water bubbling up from below. And yes, it does contain X percent of groundwater that has not had nearly as much contact with the surface before it made its way into the ground. But those river rises often have, they're not as pure as the water coming out at Weekiwachee or many other springs.
Yeah.
All right. Now I know. This is like being back in grad school, but it's not costing me a fortune. This is great.
Because I always wondered about that. So, I mean, are they like whirlpools? Could you get sucked into a swallow?
You know, I don't know that I've ever seen them that significant. What I will say is that I have gone canoeing on Santa Fe River, and yeah, they can appear whirlpool-ish. Mm-hmm. And if there's like leaves on the surface, it's pretty easy to see the circling of the water. But it's not like something out of the movies where you go, oh, my God, get out of the way. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not anxious to, like, you know, canoe over it because I don't want things to change real quick. And I'm out of control, for example. But I've never known them to be so significant that they're like capable of dragging people underwater.
Not like in the movies then.
Right, right, right. Now that's not to issue a challenge to people to try it. I don't recommend it. That's just what I think.
We need to have a little disclaimer here. The Florida Spectacular podcast does not endorse kayaking over a swallow.
Same way from quicksand. Don't go to quicksand either.
Right. Just leave that alone.
So I want to ask you, too, a little bit about the Florida Studies program. Is there anything people who have not ever heard of this program, how would you describe it?
Oh, boy. First of all, it's an interdisciplinary program, or at least that's how it began. There are no other graduate programs, and frankly, I don't think there are undergraduate programs in the state that are dedicated to the study of Florida. We offer a master's degree. The program originated a little more than 20 years ago, essentially by having folks take a wide range of courses and in a wide range of disciplines. And by the way, I'll bet half of any Florida Studies students' classes do not have the word Florida in them, right? They might be a course about World War II. Now, that particular course may have hefty chunks of material on, well, what was the impact of World War II on Florida? But it obviously deals with the World War II, the big picture. And that's true for a handful of other classes. Now, at the same time, well, yeah, we do offer coursework in early Florida history or modern Florida history or Florida Springs or geography of Florida. But there are a handful of other courses that maybe don't have much in the way to do with Florida at all. For example, if you were to talk about a subject like gentrification, right, the process where urban areas that have lacked investment for some time some people might call them a little bit run down or whatever, are then invaded, so to speak, by people who have a little money to invest, often younger people who buy inexpensive properties near city center and rejuvenate them. And of course, then they become much more valuable, much more expensive, and so on and so forth. That's a process that goes on everywhere, right? Not just in Florida. And so the point is that a lot of, you know, a lot of what we teach are about issues, processes, and so forth that happen all over the place, including Florida. And so they help people round out their understanding of what's going on around us. But yeah, I challenge anybody to find a Florida Studies program anywhere, well, anywhere in the country, but certainly the only place you'd expect to find it would be in Florida. There are a few places, you know, I think that flirt with Florida Studies, but there's nobody who offers a master's degree. And by the way, not just a master's degree, we also offer a 9-credit hour, that's just 3 classes, certificate program, where you take the same introduction to grad study that is developed specifically for Florida Studies students, and 2 other Florida-ish classes, whether they are history or geography or Springs, and you can just earn a Florida Studies certificate and learn a fair bit about Florida in that way, and then maybe make a decision to say, okay, I could use those classes and continue for a master's degree or not.
Moreover, so I want to ask you, what about people? I mean, this is all based in St. Petersburg, right?
Yes.
Is there any chance that any of those classes are offered, like the certificate or anything like that, for people? Because I know a lot of people I run across when I'm talking, you know, when I speak about my books and I talk about the Florida Studies program, it gets a lot of interest, but it's really hard to convince somebody in Fernandina Beach to commute for the St. Pete campus. You know, is there, yes, are any of that, are there anything, do you, I know with Zoom, with the pandemic, a lot of things went online. Is there any, can somebody dabble with just a class online? Is there anything remote?
Well, thank you for asking that, because the answer is, not until very recently. We finally got permission to offer a few classes online so that students could take the earn the Florida Studies certificate. USF wants badly to make sure that any classes they offer online meet their standard of quality. And they have limited resources. They can't help everybody who wants to put these courses online. We finally got permission to put 3 classes online. So I'm going to begin to develop the intro class, the required intro class. And by the way, that's required for certificate and master's students. I'm going to work on developing that in an online format this coming spring, and it'll be available for people to take in fall of 2025. And then we're also going to have a course, a seminar in early Florida history that will also be developed in online format. And then geography of Florida will also be developed in online format. We'll offer these things, or develop these things, and then offer them one at a time, starting in fall 2025.
All right. Well, we will put in the show notes definitely the link to the Florida Studies program, because I know I hear a lot of people who will say to me, I didn't know there was something like that. I would love to do it. Tell me more about it. And then when you say, well, yeah, it's this great campus, St. Pete downtown, they're like, oh, well, that's an 8-hour drive. So I think there's going to be, I mean, it's, people want to know about Florida. Obviously, I clearly believe that pretty strongly. People, especially people who move here, they want to feel good. They want to know what's going on in their state. So this is something that really, I think, appeals to a lot of folks. So yeah, that's good news. I'm glad, finally.
Absolutely. We are inching in that direction. And if we get sufficient response to that, if sufficient numbers of people enroll in these online classes, we can then use that as evidence. And part of what the university is doing is they're saying, look, show me the evidence, right? You and I hear from people here and there who say they would love to learn more about this or maybe even work on a master's degree in Florida studies. But the university says, show me those who are willing to enroll. And that's a hard thing to prove. But if we put these three classes online and people can begin with a certificate, then we can maybe prove to the university that, see, people really do want this sort of thing. Would you please help us invest in developing a handful more such courses so that people can earn a master's degree in Florida studies?
Well, I'm all in favor of it. So let us know when it happens, and maybe we'll have a couple of your students on to talk about why it's such a great thing. But anyway, sorry, back to the springs. I got distracted.
No, I think that's a great topic. I first learned of Florida studies when I went to a water symposium, 2012, 2011, with Bob Martinez, former governor, and John Moran was there, and there was a poet. And that's where I first learned of the program, because I was interested in learning more about the history of Florida waters. And it was amazing. And I considered, if it weren't for I-4, considered it. But one of the things I wanted to ask very quickly is, it's there's still an emphasis on the arts and humanities as part of that program, because that's what I heard back then, that they really wanted to kind of increase awareness through the arts and humanities.
Much more so, absolutely. We're a small program, so we can't study everything, and I wish we could, and there are gaping holes and all of that. And, you know, maybe one of these days, maybe after we develop an online program and we can reach more people and more people express an interest, maybe we can develop some additional areas that we have not been able to develop so far. But right now we have significant specialization in things like history of Florida, for sure, literature, Florida, as well as geography and environmental studies. And I sort of lump those together because I'm talking much more about sort of the environmental impacts or environmental geography generally. That said, we're beginning to offer occasionally Florida politics, occasionally offering Florida archaeology. We've got a professor who works out at Whedon Island and has some students out there. So occasionally we'll have courses like that, even if we emphasize much more or have more course offerings in history, geography, environment, and occasionally literature.
So I think it's funny you said occasionally offer Florida politics. For me, when I went through the program, I had to take that class. That was one of the core classes, or at least I was told.
Yeah. Retirements have consequences, and sometimes people retire. And this is the thing about a lot of people assume that, oh, somebody's retired, then they're replaced with somebody who does what they do. The sad truth is that that often does not happen. Often what will happen is that somebody retires and then, you know, cash-strapped administrators say, well, we're going to use the money for that salary, and we're going to hire a chemist because we see more pre-med students or something like that. That kind of thing happens all the time, and it is a source of frustration and sadness. But, you know, we found other ways to try and cope with this by occasionally hiring an adjunct instructor. So that's what I mean by occasionally we'll offer things, whether it's Florida politics or otherwise, because sometimes we can find somebody at the right place, right time, who's willing to help us in that regard.
Oh, I hated the class, so don't get me wrong. It was my least favorite class. I was just curious how it changed.
She's damaged by it.
I'm not damaged. It was just so many people could have taught that class, and I think I had somebody who was just maybe, you know, the guy from Ferris Bueller, Ben, Ben Stein.
No, Ben Stein.
Ben Stein taught like that in the Ferris Bueller movie, and it wasn't as engaging as I hoped it would be.
Well, I'm saddened for that.
It's all right. I took some stuff out of it.
You know, my suspicion is we don't have nearly as much of that, and we have much more in the way of engagement. And by the way, this is the kind of thing that USF wants to insist upon in terms of online course development. They're like, no. This has to be quality. You have to do this right, or we're not going to do it at all. So they put us through the ringer in terms of making us answer a lot of questions, being specific about a lot of things that maybe we might not be specific in the classroom. I mean, it's not the same thing as a classroom experience. That has benefits as well. But anyhow.
So can we talk a little bit about the politics of Springs, which is a major part of your book? Because in my mind, that's one of the challenges why Springs restoration hasn't been a bigger priority is the politics involved.
Oh, boy. Yes.
Sorry, we may not have enough time.
we might not. It is a significant challenge. Look, I start off in the book by saying, and I was trying to be generous, trying to be charitable, by saying that most politicians either want to fix problems or look like they're fixing problems. And sadly, I think there are more who would prefer to look like they're fixing problems rather than actually doing the hard work of fixing problems. I'm not here to name names or any of that. The bottom line is that there are some good and earnest people who are as frustrated as the rest of us Springs advocates for the lack of action. But I completely agree with the idea that sometimes our elected officials spend too much time looking like they're solving problems. For instance, saying that we spend $50 million a year on Springs restoration. First of all, that sounds like a pretty big number. And oh my gosh, it's every year. And isn't that wonderful? But if you look carefully at what they're spending that money on, it's not really Springs restoration. I'm not saying they're wasting money, but a lot of it's on improved sewage treatment, which I'm all in favor of. I think that's a wonderful thing. Good use of state dollars to improve sewage treatment. But I think they're pretending that those significant investments in improved sewage treatment are going to improve Springs' quality. And we remain frustrated because the results are not there. And they're not likely to be there because, except in rare cases, improved sewage treatment is not going to help Springs, not in a significant way. And so I think it's silly to make a big deal about spending $50 million a year on Springs restoration when most of it is not really going to do anything or much of anything. Now, this is complicated by the fact that what do we need to do to restore Springs? What would help? Man, part of the big problem is excess algae in Springs. Where's that algae coming from? Well, lots of people think that excess algae comes from excess plant nutrients like nitrogen. And there has been significant increases in nitrogen in Florida's groundwater and in the springs over the past handful of decades. But there is some evidence that suggests it's not just about nitrogen. There are other factors that could conceivably be leading to this excess algae in springs, and that nitrogen is just being held up to be the boogeyman. And not for nefarious reasons, by the way. Excess nitrogen in slow-moving waters like Lake Okeechobee is clearly causing a problem. But spring water typically moves a fair bit faster than lake water, right?
The flow has been decreased considerably, and I think that's a factor too.
Yes, It has. And some people would say, yes, exactly. That reduction in flow is not only problematic for many species that depend on it, it also no longer pushes algae away and allows it to accumulate in several springs. I mean, that is one hypothesis that a few people have done some work on, and I don't think we can prove it yet. I don't think it's risen to the level of theory, but I think it should be given strong consideration and maybe some additional investigation in other spring settings to help us see that, yeah, this really is consistently happening in other
places. So if it's not flow and it's not nitrogen, what else could be causing the algae?
Well, part of this may be a function of dissolved oxygen levels. Dissolved oxygen is crucial, obviously, for the fish, but they're also crucial for the snails that eat algae. And if for whatever reason there is a significant loss or drop in dissolved oxygen, it may be more than those algae grazers can tolerate, and it may kill them off. As you know, if human beings go without oxygen for more than 5 minutes, we have very serious problems, right?
Doesn't work out well, yeah.
No, it doesn't. And it doesn't work out well for algae grazers either. And if they go missing, well, you tell me what happens to your lawn if you stop mowing it, right? The grass grows pretty high, it's prolific, blah, blah, blah. And then, even when you get the lawnmower back, your grass may be so high that it can't cut. You may have to hire somebody who has much more heavy equipment. Well, in springs, just because the snails return doesn't mean they can go back to reducing that algae to the way it was before there was a problem. So there's the beginnings of an idea that, man, dissolved oxygen levels are really important. And frankly, we're not even sure if that's the only connection. We're just suspecting that maybe it's part of it. And then what role does spring reversal play in dissolved oxygen? There are some places, especially along the Suwannee and Santa Fe rivers, where heavy rainfall can raise the level of river and force water into springs, water that has lots of organic material. It already happens in some of those swallow holes we were talking about earlier.
Right.
But it can also happen, you know, in a much wider variety of springs. And all of that stuff is basically food for bacteria that consume oxygen.
Oh, I've never thought about that. I know that happens at Wakulla, doesn't it? The flow reversal that sometimes...
I don't know about Wakulla Springs, but certainly in neighboring areas, there's lots of places. For instance, at White Sulphur Springs, in White Springs up in North Florida, that one, and we've seen it the last time I went there. With a class full of students, we saw river water was a little bit higher, and it was pouring into the old concrete or the old structure for the spring house.
The spring house, yeah.
Was going down into the spring. And that's not the only place it happens, of course. It can happen in a variety of other places. Poe Springs in Gainesville, I think, can happen.
Yeah.
It can happen there as well.
This is a lot. it's been 45 minutes, and I feel like we're just getting started, but it's all the time we have right now. You are always welcome back to talk about springs. You haven't even told us what your favorite spring is, or what your least favorite spring is. Rick has big feelings on springs. I took a group to a certain spring once. He's like, no, you can't go there. It's horrible.
And there were great springs right down the road. So,
well, you know, the University Press told me I originally planned a much larger book, and the second half of the book was going to focus on a series of significant Florida springs. And they told me, look, you can't make a book this big. Nobody will buy it. You know, maybe crack this thing in two. So that's the next thing, is to maybe try to produce a second book that focuses on the stories associated with selected springs in Florida.
Oh, very cool.
I'm in favor of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the things that excites me is that each of these springs have very interesting stories.
Yes.
And that's kind of was my motivation with Healing Waters.
Well, and that crystal clear on that one, and beautifully written, I might add.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Just keep the praise coming.
All right. Dr. Mindel, Chris, we're going to definitely put a link to your book in the show notes, because I think this is one of those Florida books that if you care about the Florida environment, it needs to be on your permanent bookshelf. This is not a read and return book. Also not a bad idea. Christmas is coming up.
Just saying.
Christmas gift. Just saying. Hanukkah's December 25th. Christmas is December 25th. Maybe you give somebody the Florida Springs book and take them kayaking for the new year. Just a thought. Your good companion book for that is Florida's Healing Waters, which is, coincidentally, we know the author.
And we talked about the value of cover art just the other day on our podcast.
Yeah,
a beautiful Mark Long photo on the cover. It's kind of one of those half and half pictures of a photo of a spring. It's beautiful.
I'm so grateful for Mark's willingness to contribute that photo to the cover. It is beautiful.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for being here. Let us know whenever you want to come back. I think Rick could talk to you for another 5 hours.
But, probably.
anyway, thanks for being here. Rick, good to see you again. And we'll see you all next time on the Florida Spectacular.
And thank you guys for the invitation. This was wonderful.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.